This is your community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
As Sandra noted, coming up right now is The Space Show. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and with me on Mission Control is Richard. Tonight, devoted to one topic only, and that is the ethics of space colonization, or as some would prefer to say, space settlement, because there's no one out there to colonize. So we're going to be hearing from Gordon Young, Principal of Ethological Consulting. But first, a special message for our 35th birthday on Southern FM.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. And you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is The Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
We are proud to have been with Southern FM for all but 5 months of its 35 years. So, on The Space Show, to our topic tonight, the ethics of space colonization. This is a recording we made at the Space Association meeting some time ago, and we're going to be hearing from Gordon Young, the principal of Ethological Consulting. He's also a lecturer on professional ethics at the School of Design at RMIT University. So over to Gordon.
So, yeah, very excited to talk to you about successful space colonization. Perhaps easily one of the most far-reaching topics there is going. So just to really cap things off right at the start here, good question to start with. What are we talking about when we're talking about ethics? Very simply put, not this. We're not trying to predict the future, or more accurately, we're not trying to say with any degree of certainty what is going to happen. You might be surprised to also learn I'm not going to be sitting up here telling you what is right and wrong either. Instead, we're going to be looking at it more like this: potential future pathways, opportunities, risks, etc. So broadly put, decision-making methodologies that maximize accuracy, minimize error, and best accommodate practical realities of human nature, several of which we're going to talk about tonight. In large part, this comes down to risk assessment. The simple fact is that you can't really judge the right and wrong of a thing if you're not sure what its nature is going to be. Now, this is particularly true with emergent technologies. So, you know, social media is a very present one, but we still don't understand the full implications of that yet. And so we're forced to take a risk assessment sort of approach with this. But we can do some pretty interesting things, which you'll see in a minute. Now, I'd normally recap space travel so far, but I think that's a little redundant for this audience. What is interesting, however, is several recent projects, including the Rosetta shot, SpaceX managing to land their reusable booster, and in particular, around about 2004 on this chart at least, where private industry started to take a leading role with space exploration in general. So that, combined with some recent media, you will be familiar with The Martian, whether or not that's entirely accurate, I'll leave up to you. But at the same time, what this has done is repopularized the idea in many people's minds. Suddenly, there's a lot of media attention for it. We've seen Elon Musk with his Mars shot, etc. We're talking about all sorts of innovations in this space. Suddenly, it's in the public consciousness again, which is much more important because now it's in the politicians' consciousness again. And if you want ethics, that's where you look. Now, that might be a little ways off yet, but at the same time, it's on the cards. And so we're seeing a lot of innovation and a lot of investment, as was mentioned in the prelude here. So I won't be bothered with any of this. This is the bit where then you find out whether or not I'm pro-space travel or not. There are numerous benefits to the point where it is basically an essential part of human development. The most obvious one being resources. We have limited resources on this planet by its very nature. Some we have more of and some we have less of, but nonetheless, we are at some point going to need more. Room for expansion follows with that. Population growth is exponential, barring something awful in the future, but at the moment it is exponential. eventually, barring some very unpleasant draconian measures to limit that population growth, we will need to go somewhere else. Technological innovation, I mean, yeah, that's fairly self-evident, especially for this audience. Investment into this space drives innovation in a number of other spaces as well, right? This is for the benefit of everyone. And scientific research, getting out there to the thing is a much easier way of testing a thing than doing it remotely, which we are currently limited to doing. But perhaps the most interesting one, and the one that really seals the deal as far as I'm concerned, is the question of redundancy or security, which I believe there was a Facebook post on this comment on this event earlier on, but I think absolutely nailed it. We only have one planet, which is to say that we've got all of our eggs in one basket in a very serious way. Should something occur that was to threaten the safety of the planet, then we are stuffed, as it were. Having a second option, or better yet, multiple options, gives us redundancy, which means that should something like this get a little bit closer than it actually was, and we didn't even notice until it passed, we have backups, so to speak. It's for the security of the species as a whole, not to mention several other species for that matter. But there is one final reason that I think we don't want to gloss over too much here, and that's just because we want to. Now, when I say this, I don't just mean just for, you know, whims. I mean that we as a species, in particular as individuals, always seek purpose in what we do. And it really cannot be underestimated how significant of a driver this is. This study here, for example, you'll notice this plant here, almost half of the US employees would take a pay cut in exchange for a job that aligns with their values. We are constantly seeking purpose in what we do. Doesn't matter what that purpose is necessarily, so long as we feel that it's there. Alternatively, we're always avoiding this. That horrible question of what is the point? Why am I here? What are we doing this for? Right? This is a constant struggle in the academic sector, as you can imagine. If a student leaves the classroom saying, what was the point of that? The class might as well have not have run. And there's also wanderlust, you know, the desire to see new things and to explore, a massive driver of human behavior. Perhaps more so than it should be, but that's where we're at. So where's the problem? Why are we talking about ethics here, if it's so great? Well, consider some of the problems humanity currently faces, and we'll run through some of those, but consider also this question. Would these cease when we left the planet? And what would the implications be? So amongst others, wealth and power disparity and subsequent abuse. Wildly different ideas of what is right and what is wrong and little effort to reconcile worldviews. We rarely talk about ethics. Anyone ever notice that? It's a funny one. If you ever stand in a room with 100 people and say, is everyone in here ethical? Or does everyone in here have an idea of what ethics are? Everyone nods their head. And then you ask them for a definition and you get 100 different definitions. You can see how this would be a problem, right? Because everyone thinks they're working towards the same goal. Everyone thinks they know what they're talking about with that. As soon as you get down to the nuts and bolts, things get a little bit ugly. Competition and tension between groups. Yeah, we have a bit of a competitive drive. It's one of these evolutionary holdovers, which we'll touch on later on. But it's a thing. People see an opportunity, they tend to go for it. Should they? Doesn't really matter, does it? They can, so they do. Exponential consumption of shared resources. So climate change, amongst other things, oceans, fishing stocks, etc., is a tendency for us to overdo that, and for reasons I'll explore in a minute. And as I said before, the human condition. Humans are not that far removed from our animal past, and you can see that very clearly when you look at some of the cognitive factors that are at play. We'll go into some details. Now, we have a nice illustrative issue here. That said, surely space travel is going to go a long way to addressing these problems in and of itself. Abundance of resources takes away the competition, right? We have a plethora of materials and so forth. Surely we don't have to fight over them quite as much. Similarly, ultimate freedom of movement means, well, if you don't like people, you just get away from them, right? And choices of one group subsequently need not affect others, right? You don't like it on this planet, go to the other one. You know, go have yours over there. Go away from us. And if we don't like you, we can go away as well. The confined and shared space of Earth has certainly accelerated many of these problems, or made them significantly worse, because we are, whether we like it or not, kind of stuck in each other's pocket, at least on a broad scale. So let's move past all this for the moment. These are current issues. We've done it. Congratulations. We're off planet now. We're heading off out to the stars. The question really becomes, what happens next? Will the problems of humanity simply fade away because we left the planet, not because of anything else, but simply because we got away from each other, or have we just given them room? And so this is where the ethics comes in. Now, regardless of which method of ethics you use, and there's dozens, obviously, but not really relevant for now, they require two things to work. Every method of ethics, no matter which one, requires two things. Complete and accurate data. In order to make a decision about a thing, you need to know what you're dealing with. You need as much information about the thing as you can get. And a rational analysis of that data. Now, I need to, thanks to Ben Shapiro, I need to throw in at this point and say that there's a tendency to conflate emotion with irrationality. False. Emotions are heuristics. They're very, very valuable at helping us process enormous amounts of data. But irrational in this case basically means 1 plus 1 equals 2. If you come at me with 1 plus 1 equals 14, we have a problem. That is not accurate, right? So a combination of a large volume of data processed accurately, perhaps, to come to a conclusion about the situation. We can't do either. Hence, every single problem that we have, right? When it comes to society in general, it's simply not possible. Don't take this as a criticism necessarily of a given individual or a given group. Though, of course, you will be familiar with Isaac Asimov's quote here about a cult of ignorance in the United States. We're seeing going very much out of control at this point. The idea that my ignorance is equal to your facts or evidence or your science, right? Now, of course, he's talking about the US here, but it's not limited to the US in any means or shape. It's not limited to any political creed or otherwise. There's people that I am on the same side as that very much fall into this category as well. But beyond the social factor, and also bear in mind that this factor is not just necessarily a matter of ignorance in itself, it's also the capacity of vested interests to exploit that ignorance to drive an agenda that they wish. Bad faith engagement, right? But it's not just a matter of the software, so to speak, it's also the hardware. We're stuck with this. We can't upgrade it. It's pretty incredible, don't get me wrong, but at the end of the day, your brain is your brain. You can't change it. It has limited storage. It has limited function. It has its irrationalities. It's basically a chemical ball.
On the Space Show this evening, we are listening to Gordon Young, the principal of Ethological Consulting. Let's go back to his talk to the Space Association of Australia in South Melbourne.
We also aren't very good with unprecedented situations. Facebook being a very good example of this, particularly in the context of that Cambridge Analytica thing. I don't know about you, but I never thought of Facebook as a potentially influencing the US presidential elections thing, right? It was MySpace. It was like a texting app as far as I was concerned. I never really paid that much attention to it. And the next thing you know, right? Why? Because it's very hard to predict how a new innovation is going to alter how people behave. Right? We still, incidentally, don't know what effect social media has on people's psychology. Does it make them depressed? We don't know because we don't have enough data. Consider this. It's only been around for about 10 years. What is the effect of social media use, prolonged social media use, on a person of 14 or of an early teenager? How on earth would we know? We've only got one sample group for that, and they're still using it, right? In other words, we have a lot of trouble with that situation. And finally, there's good old entropy. Simple fact is, in order to know everything, you would need more processing power than is available in the entire universe. So there will always be limits. In terms of rationality, on the other hand, welcome to the Cognitive Bias Codex. Yeah. There are 188 known cognitive biases to the human brain as known by psychological science. I'm betting there's probably a bunch more, but these are the ones we have documented so far. Now, to zoom in one of those quadrants there, you can see that you've got the biases listed along here. But what I find really useful about the way this is put together is it doesn't just look at them as purely negative things. Cognitive biases, for those that are uninitiated, are essentially bugs in human thinking. Heuristics, if you like, logical shortcuts, a way of dealing with a lot of data in a very short period of time. But you'll notice stereotyping is in there. You've got, just so many of the damn things. But you'll notice them if you start looking for them. People just make assumptions. I'll give an example in a minute. But what this codex does is it looks at why we have these in there. For example, we notice when something has changed, bizarre, funny, or visually striking, stick out more so, and we are drawn to details that confirm our existing beliefs. But why? Why would that stick around in the human psyche over a period of time? And the broad conclusion drawn here is that we have too much information. There is more information in this room than a human being is capable of even detecting, much less doing anything with. We have to function. And so you can see how something like stereotyping, for example, while in itself a logical fallacy, in practice, out in the jungle, if you see an orange thing, well, the logical thing to do would be to investigate the thing and find out what the orange thing is. But if the last seven times that happened, everyone died, fair to say that that's not a smart move, right? Safety, survival over reason or rationality. It's all still in there. We're dragging it around with us. To give an example, confirmation bias is the big mama of all of these in many ways. This is the tendency for people to seek out sources of information that confirms what they already believe, rather and avoid sources of information that tend to conflict with what they believe. In very simple Melbourne terms, if you read the Herald Sun, you probably don't read The Age, and if you read The Age, you probably don't read the Herald Sun, right? In the sense that it's not pleasant to be around people who disagree with you constantly, particularly on deeply held beliefs. It's unpleasant, right? Anyone had a conversation with an anti-vaxxer? Or in this context, particularly a flat earth theorist? Anyone? It's truly distressing, right? There's ways around that, but in the meantime, it's like just this tendency means that you stray away from those groups, which becomes a problem because what if that group has a point you won't even know, right? And even if they don't have a valid point, much like the flat earth is, you won't understand what they're doing. Yeah, I don't know about you, but Donald Trump's election got me completely by surprise. Why? Because I had no idea what the other side of the fence was up to, right? So looking at all these various issues here, the unfortunate conclusion is that, at least for the moment, barring any sort of transhumanism or the upgrading of the human brain on a hardware level, these aren't going anywhere. They're part of who we are. They're part of our nature, which is a problem. It's not to say we can't do anything about them, but it does say that we will default back to this if given a chance. I'll give you an example of that in a minute. Okay. So I said before that the confined and shared nature of the Earth has exacerbated a lot of problems that we've had up to date, but it's done a couple of other things as well. It's kept them contained. And it's also meant that we are forced to face the consequences of our actions and subsequently overcome them or not. But the point is that our confined nature up until now has served as a de facto form of accountability. You better fix the problems or you're not getting out of here. Right? A corporate example, the classic here, being is like, oh, geez, I hear about the problems over in the sales department. Oh, geez, I'm glad it's not affecting us. Oh, boy. The number of organizations I have been into where you've had to hammer home the very simple point that the people experience on the bottom level of the organization who are actually doing the coalface work aren't telling management there's a problem that is slowly snowballing and going to sink the entire organization because management don't want to hear it, right? That one simple thing can kill an entire business that would otherwise be fixable or salvageable. So to give a few examples of how this could apply in a space colonization sense, is anyone familiar with the tragedy of the commons? Yeah, a few people? All right, so this is an economic theorem, essentially saying that you're using the metaphor of a common or a green in the middle of a village, an unregulated space. There is a green place in the village. It's owned by everyone. No one regulates it. Everyone keeps a cow on it, right? Works out well. It's been done for generations. And then some entrepreneur puts two cows on the green. What happens next? Well, some will go, well, no, we'd like to stick with how it's been done, thanks very much. But other people will go, oh, hang on, they've doubled their profits. So they chuck a cow on the green as well. And then three cows. And really, at that point, it's an unregulated space. No one can tell you what to do with it. So why wouldn't you put 50 cows on the green? Right? Problem being, of course, is that this will undermine the viability of the resource itself. You can see this in environmental issues such as climate change, commonly owned resources, international fishing as well, for that matter, plastics in the ocean, yada, 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 all fun stuff. But the point is, space is the ultimate unregulated resource. Now, if it is all accessible all at once, this is unlikely to ever become a problem. Issue being, that's not likely to happen, is it? It's going to be moon first, asteroid belt maybe following that, Mars, et cetera, and so forth. There will always be limitations on what we can access, but when we move off the planet, who's in charge? No one, right? Meaning that it's going to be a bit of a free-for-all, meaning that these sort of problems, while incredibly predictable and very obviously self-destructive from the outside, are all but guaranteed unless managed proactively.
We'll be back with Gordon Young from Ethological Consulting after these messages.
Local, live and community-based.
Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are looking at the ethics of space colonisation, and our guide is Gordon Young, the principal of Ethological Consulting. He's also a lecturer in professional ethics at the School of Design at RMIT University. So let's go back to the Space Association meeting.
Speaking of opportunism, does anyone know about the 1923 Melbourne police strike? This is a classic. This is possibly the only example worldwide of police going on strike, and I mean entirely on strike. This happened in Melbourne, and guess what? 3 hours after they all went on strike, looting everywhere. Now, you're probably looking there and thinking like, well, I wouldn't do that. That's not the point. People will. There are people that will. They will see that as an opportunity. They will think that you're stupid for not doing it, right? So inevitably, there will be enough of a groundswell. And we do know this from various studies of psychology, particularly of crowds, that people will do things they would never, ever do as an individual if they're part of a big crowd, right? And so that was the result here. We had a, it's quite fascinating to read the reports about it, but it was, yeah, it was absolutely just, it was like anarchy. But what's interesting is what resulted from that. There was a period of anarchy that lasted about 5 or 6 hours, shopkeepers defending their property as much as they could, et cetera, but brawls, everything. Then a citizens' militia was formed, more or less spontaneously. Why? Because they had to, right? You can't just let this run. It's going to destroy the whole purpose of having a society in the first place, right? Finally, that citizens' militia got formed into the new official police force and all the striking police got fined, right? What we can see here is a sort of a convergent sort of process of civilization. Yeah, you can abandon all trappings of humanity, all of your civilization. We can start a completely free and totally unregulated space. It will regulate by its nature because it is necessary for anyone to have any degree of security. So this will lead to some, but in the meantime, you get your looting. Now, in terms of space colonization, I'm guessing that would be piracy and various raids, corporate opportunism. Either way, stepping up a stage, well, you've already covered this, haven't you, in the prelim? Good old arms race. Standard stuff. Now, if we had been talking about this even a year ago, this wouldn't have been quite as relevant, but here we are. Obviously, we have a bit of a template for this already with the old Star Wars model, but more recently, as touched on here, Space Force. Now, the more modern versions of this do make a lot more sense, the one that was launched by President Trump, less so. But as a aside to this, does anyone know about this project here, the Nuke the Moon? Has anyone heard of this? This was a thing. During the Cold War, the United States Air Command decided that they could, as a show of intimidation and supremacy, nuke the moon, so that it would be visible from the planet. The idea being as a show of strength to the Soviets. Now, this didn't go ahead for a number of reasons, thank goodness, but at the same time, this was on the table of the United States government. You know, this wasn't some fringe loon, right, messing around in the backyard. This wasn't the equivalent of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. We're talking about one of the major superpower at the time. Thought about nuking the moon basically as a way of showing off. Never assume they're above stuff like this. Something a little bit more mundane, limits of growth, human population growth. It is exponential by its very nature. And it does tend to slow down in developed countries, which is interesting. I'm seeing that in Australia there at the moment. We're not quite at parity yet, but in a lot of developed countries, it does seem to slow down to more or less replacement level. But in the meantime, we are increasing at an incredible rate. Whether we're past carrying capacity in Australia is a very open question, frankly, but it's technological innovation helping along there, but still. But we're going to need to go somewhere. And the thing is that at an exponential rate, even if you do move off planet, well, it's exponential. How much longer is it going to take? We certainly don't have exponential access to planets, at least not yet. And then finally, there's that, oh, well, not quite finally, but there is the question of irreversible decisions. Now, this one's really quite far-reaching, but anyone familiar with, or anyone interested in the question of artificial intelligence? Now, you can talk about true artificial intelligence and the whole concept of the singularity, right, where the artificial intelligence surpasses human intelligence, one of the leading theories then being that it would seek to self-improve. Kind of a genie you can't put back in the bottle, right? You better hope it's benevolent at that point because it's not going back. You can extend that to other things such as chemical or biological weapons or any of these sort of decisions that you would never do on this planet because it would be incredibly stupid. You're stuck here along with everyone else. But when you're off planet, well, you always have a backup. Trouble being is you can't put that genie back in. So if it does get out of control, oh dear. But finally, and unfortunately, perhaps the most realistic scenario here, and I do apologize for this imagery, but it is what it is. Nazis are back. This is at the Grampians last year, or 2 years ago, I believe. We have neo-Nazis back on the rise. They've always been here, but they're getting bolder. Now, the reason I bring this up, to each their own. Do you remember that unlimited freedom of movement I mentioned earlier on? The fact that you can, or you don't like it, you go somewhere else. The old love it or leave it concept. You can finally take that literally to the point where you don't even have to be on the same planet as these people. I'm sick to death of the politics in this country or whatever agenda that I might have. I'm going to go and do it over there and it's going to be great, right? Yeah. Is that going to work out? Most groups that do that will leave everyone else alone. Most Nazis won't. History is repeating itself right now. I mean, for God's sake, we have a land war in Europe, for Christ's sake, in 2022. Who would have thought, right? Unfortunately, not me, which is a bit of a failing professionally, frankly. But either way, this is always viable, right? Just because they moved way the hell over there doesn't mean they won't come back. And if the reason they moved way the hell over there was so that they could start up their nationalistic, militaristic organization, well, seems plausible, doesn't it? Like I said, we've spread. We haven't improved necessarily. And unfortunately, the net result of that is that if an ideology is allowed to spread, then you may very well see history repeat itself on a number of levels. If you have your fundamentalist Christian planet, they'll still have gay kids. What are they going to do with them? And, of course, always a viable outcome. Free labor. Hopefully less economically valuable in the future as automation takes off. But always a thing that can happen.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Space Show on Solon FM. And our topic is the ethics of space colonization. Our speaker is Gordon Young, the principal of Ethological Consulting. We recorded this at the meeting of the Space Association of Australia in South Melbourne. Let's go back to the talk.
Now, to turn this around, the benefits still persist. What I'm describing here are risks, not certainties, risks. And they do not in any way take away from the benefits of doing this, which will more or less make this sort of development kind of inevitable. The fact that these things are possible and viable means that this technology and the changes, if we can do it, will happen, right? Problem is they come with the risks, part and parcel, right? So what are we going to do about it? What are our options here? Are we going to create a galactic utopia or launch an interstellar plague or both? Most importantly, how do we control these outcomes? Future-proofing, essentially. So the future is now, as tacky as it is to say that, but follow me with it. What the future is going to look like is largely laid down now and in the past decades, but there's not a lot we can do about those. More so than any other topic, this is true of successful space travel, right? Because this is a long, long-term enterprise, yeah? And unfortunately, as we've seen in the past, it tends to wane out of the public consciousness and back in and back out and back in, and it will do many, many times before we get around to, you know, full-blown actually being able to do this. technological challenges such as automation, artificial intelligence, advanced communication will all change humanity to some degree, but space travel will absolutely amplify us. Everything we are when we hit that point will be massively amplified on every conceivable level. I think I heard someone mention The Expanse. Was it you, sir? Yeah. Fantastic show. Interesting. A plausible future, but it's done a very good job. It could be better, but the theory underlying or the story underlying it does a wonderful job of looking at how a modern mindset or modern sociological issues could be expanded just on a bigger scale. So, I have some recommendations for you, and I've tried to make this as specific to the Space Association as I can. So, first and foremost, transparency. The nature of the means determines the quality of the ends. You may have heard this on an ethical level, the whole question of means versus ends. Is any means justified if the ends is good enough? Trick question. The means determine the nature of the ends, right? You can't achieve world peace by punching everyone in the face because you just set a standard for everyone punching each other in the face. Peace ain't going to last very long. Now, therefore, we can't really determine whether the progress we're making is positive and going in the right direction unless we know what is happening, right? And if we can determine the quality thereof. Now, privatization of space travel has made this somewhat more complicated than it was. I mean, the Cold War was a lot worse, but this has made it complicated as well, because now this technology and the development is a matter of intellectual property, right? So the actual details, maybe not so forthcoming, but perhaps more distressing, private investment means private agendas. We don't know what the intention is because they're not going to tell us, right? And so for space travel to be a public good, which I believe we very much should treat it as one, it must be treated as a public good. In terms of what this means for the Space Association, I'm always keen to make this as practical as possible for the audience I'm presenting to. I mean, I'm always of the attitude that if I leave a talk and I'm not sure what I meant to do with that, what was the point, right? So let's talk about what you can realistically do about this. I would consider your association to be a thought leader in this space. Simple fact is that ethics requires fully informed decisions, and the public is not fully informed. The public is not even close to fully informed. The vast majority, while it has come back into the public consciousness, right now it's kind of PR, shall we say. It's a bit glitzy, right? It's Twitter quotes, it's infographics, it's all this sort of stuff. It's a start. It gives you a foothold, to say the least. But it is essential that the public knows what is going on to an accurate degree, what is and is not possible, in order to avoid being taken advantage of by bad faith actors. Is anyone familiar that you can buy a plot of land in Mars right now? Look as you can. I think Moon was a few years ago as well. People fall, there's always going to be someone that falls for these scams, right? But the point being is that public discourse on this will largely inform political will, and the political will, like it or not, is going to dictate what technology does and does not get up. You're very well positioned for this. I'm not suggesting you turn into a marketing agency overnight, but these sort of conversations and the fact that you are meeting here to discuss what is in the works and is not in the works puts you at a massive advantage to the rest of the public. Also gives you a means of talking to other people, right? Second point, accountability. This is not transparency. It's often conflated the two. Transparency is access to information. Accountability is making people change their behavior if that information reveals a problem. Specifically, the means to demand an explanation from those who infringe on your interests and compel reform to if that is unjust, right? You'll notice that this is a significantly higher bar than most people use when they talk about accountability, but yeah, that's what it is. I did my master's thesis on accountability mechanisms in the Victorian Parliament. That was a very distressing day. Oh, don't start me, seriously.
We're listening to Gordon Young talking about the ethics of space colonisation. And I think we're ready to go back to the meeting again.
Space travel is the future of the human race, right? As we talked about earlier on, in terms of the benefits, that's not just an aspirational thing, that will be a necessity for the species at some point. Thus, it is in all of our interests, which you'll notice, spelling, good job, Gordon, but apart from that, we talked about means of demanding an explanation from those who infringe on your interests. Well, are we doing this well? Hope so, because it's going to affect all of us and our long-term interests, intergenerational interests. The decisions made today will establish the foundations of future decisions and the quality of that future, as I mentioned earlier on. And so we must demand rigor in the process, right, insofar as we have any capacity to do so. What do I mean by that? I mean this. Elon Musk on his Mars shop, if something is important enough, you should try, even if it is probable, even if the probable outcome is failure. Great sentiment. Love it. Awesome. A few questions. Who will suffer the consequences of that failure? Could the failure or its impact have been met? And define important enough, please. These are not intended as criticisms of the project, right? Still, you can have the good and the bad simultaneously. Great, really good, absolutely big supporter of getting off this planet, getting off this rock, a little bit of redundancy in the system, please. I've done a lot of work around climate change. I'm pretty keen for an alternative right now. But these questions are not unreasonable. If they're in good faith, they're not unreasonable questions. And this is what I mean by rigor. It's looking past the PR and the glitz and saying, okay, cool, could you flesh that out with some detail, please, right? And finally, the big one, power dynamics. And you'll forgive the phrasing, but there is a standard test when it comes to power dynamics, and that is, what would an asshole do? There's a tendency with this sort of thing, particularly around ethics, but particularly around aspirational technologies. People tend to look at it from a best case scenario outlook. What could we achieve? What could happen as a result of that? And that's fantastic. Fortunately, you need people like me in the room to ask questions like this, because we can't know people's intentions. We can know what they say. We can know what they publish. And it's particularly true of a corporate market where they can publish very well put together PR pieces and so forth. But you must ask the question, how could this go wrong, right? We can't know intentions, so we risk manage. And risk management is not about what's going well. It's about what could go wrong and making those worst case outcomes impossible, insofar as we have the ability to do so, but we need to start with the psychological process first. What are the various parties involved in this project capable of, right? Both in a positive and negative sense. How can a positive conduct be incentivized and negative made unrewarding, right? Simple maxim when it comes to ethics in particular and corporate strategy and all this sort of thing as well. If it's rewarded, it will happen, right? My current role is with the Victorian Police. If conduct is rewarded, it will occur. Hope it's good conduct. Who's in charge of that? Me. And most importantly, how can we compel these outcomes? Now, I don't use that word lightly. I appreciate that that's a pretty damn high bar. I also appreciate it's somewhat aggressive. I'm not pulling back from it. How can you make sure the outcome is positive insofar as we have any capacity to do so? In terms of your organization, once again, being right isn't enough, I have to tell you. I wish it was. Oh, boy, do I wish it was, right? Simplify my job, to say the least. The fact that you are on the pulse about what's happening in this space, good developments, bad developments, sensible, not sensible, it's not enough in itself. It's definitely important. It's absolutely critical that it's done. And, well, congratulations. I'm glad there's an organization that's keeping an eye on things. But it's not enough. Who controls the narrative? Who does the public listen to? And who do the politicians listen to? Might be the public, might not be. Sometimes isn't. Special interests tend to get their ear a lot more so. But if there are special interests, here's a question for you. How can you take their place? If you're right, you should have the narrative. Everyone's narrative. Because you're right. Yeah, now I will, of course, exercise a degree of rigor around claims like that, but at the same time, you take the point. Who is being listened to? Are they correct? Because if they're not, well, something needs to happen about that. So, there we go. Ethics of planet colonization and the new future, as well as some things that your organization as a whole could potentially look into. I appreciate we're talking very political stuff here, and I do appreciate the organization is non-political by its nature. However, non-political doesn't mean uninvolved. It means non-partisan, no doubt. But at the same time, these are important questions that will dictate the success of your aspirations as a group, as well as everyone's aspirations, really. because if anyone is looking to answer Len's question from earlier on, if anyone around here says that they're anti-space, they're not thinking long-term enough. It's a simple inevitability when we get large enough and big enough. Unless there's a pretty substantial change to the nature of human beings, we can expect to see ourselves at least trying to get amongst the stars in very short order. So thank you very much for your time. Does anyone have any questions?
And we'll have the question and answer session after these messages.
This is Southern FM.
Southern FM.
Across Bayside Melbourne since 1990.
And this is The Space Show on Southern FM. Our topic today, the ethics of space colonisation. Well, we've heard Gordon Young's talk. Now comes the question and answer session, and it's led off by Len Halperin.
So many questions and so little time. I want to thank you very much. Certainly heard a lot of interesting things there that have got me thinking. I have formed the thought for a very long time that this is big picture stuff, and it's about we have to get off the earth, because I've used the phrase, we are a single point of failure. And if something goes pear-shaped here, whether it's by our stupidity or by nature or by whatever, there's no backup. We don't have an alpha site somewhere for all those fans of TV shows. We need an alpha, beta, gamma, and every other letter site, probably even an Omicron site. So one of the things you said reminded me of the when you were talking about the company and you showed the graphic of the leaking boat and it's not happening up our end, and you said it was down at the coalface. They were too scared to report to management because management just wasn't interested in listening to them. That was the findings of the Space Shuttle Inquiry. That's exactly what happened. The NASA engineers on the line either were too scared or knew it was no point in discussing to senior NASA management because they wanted to launch. So there's a classic case of that. Just another thing, where the politicians are involved, they think in the terms of votes. So I've often used the phrase, there are no votes in space, right? Space is not something that appeals to the earthbound politician because it's not going to win them any votes. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that. And one more thing, time frames. We're also not good at thinking in long time frames. And I agree with you, this has to be multi-generational or even multi-century, but politicians can only think to the next election. In our own experience, we can only think a few years, maybe 10 years, we think about our children. But humans' inability to think big picture in terms of space and time, how much of an issue is that and what can we do about it? So thanks very much, Gordon.
All extremely salient points. Unfortunately, just to go to the Challenger disaster in particular, and then we've repeated that so many damn times, but perhaps the most recent example that's sort of similar in nature. Anyone familiar with the Boeing 737 MAX disaster? I think, 3 years ago? Exactly the same thing. Engineers tried for months to raise concerns about that, but it quickly became apparent that if you mention that, you get fired. Not only that, but Boeing, in its infinite wisdom, had managed to onboard the FAA safety processes. They'd lobbied the government to do the FAA safety processes themselves, thereby removing every check against their own screw-ups. It's amazing, right? But again, it sort of illustrates the point that we're humans, this is part of what we do. And the bigger point to be addressed here is the simple fact that humans don't do strategic thinking very well. We're very, very good at tactical thinking. We're incredibly adaptive, incredibly adaptive. In fact, it can be a bit of a problem. We get used to things we shouldn't get used to, but we are very good at that. Yeah, I always use the analogy here between a bushfire and climate change, both pretty well-established problems, but you get a bushfire in this country and we're on it straight away. We know what we're doing. Everyone rallies together. Even if you've got no skills whatsoever, people donate in droves, right? We're good at that. But climate change, something that will cause a lot of fires over a very long period of time, can't quite get our heads around that one, right? For a number of reasons. One, it's disempowering. We as humans, we're sitting here going like, well, what the hell do I do about that? It's an international level thing. Two, we don't really have the institutions in place necessary to support that sort of huge level, long-term thinking. And third, as you point out, politicians think in four-year cycles because they have to, because of the power dynamic. The simple fact is that if you've got a visionary up who had a 40-year plan, if they get unelected the next year, well, that didn't really matter, did it? Right? We need resilience in the entirety of the whole thing, unfortunately. So, yeah, I will dispute one point you made, though, that it doesn't win votes. And you're correct in that it hasn't won votes recently, right? That can change. That can change. I mean, there is a sizable, pros and cons of Musk, but one of the big upsides of him is that he definitely has gotten a lot of people enthusiastic about this to a kind of frightening degree in some cases. There's some pretty rabidly enthusiastic individuals out there. What I will say is that it's challenging for a politician to embrace something like this because it's a risk. You know, politics tends to go negative, as I'm sure you're all aware. It's a safe bet. Anger sells. Negativity sells. It's easier to criticize than it is to propose a vision. But I will point out that the last time there's been numerous occasions of a lot of political success in doing exactly that. And I think it was last time Labor got in on a clear win was based on that long-term vision for the country, right? There was a lot of other factors at play, but that definitely helped, right? Point being, it's viable, it's risky, it's difficult, but it's a thing that can be done.
At the time that we recorded this talk, Peter Arwood was the president of the Space Association of Australia, and he had this question for Gordon Young.
I'd like to echo Len's comments. This is fantastic. A big view on that. I'm not sure what my question's going to, but I'm going to kick into it and I'll see how we go. Obviously, there's a lot of criticism of the International Space Station. What's it there for? They're whizzing around in circles. What the heck is the point of that? You know, we're not really exploring, we're not doing anything. The other side of that coin, though, is that even with the current Ukraine-Russia tensions, the US, China, etc., well, China's not involved, but the tensions, the global tensions, space has risen above that. The activities on the space station, the Russians launched some cosmonauts up there, they brought some Americans down. They haven't been sent to each other's modules and shut the door. They're still cooperating. So I think, in some ways, the ethics of how the space station operates and the agreement under which it operates is kind of a good case study in what could possibly go into the future. Obviously, if China then occupies a part of the moon and Russia occupies a part of the moon, the Americans, we're going to have our same tensions that we have on Earth up there. Mm-hmm. But let's hope we learn a little bit about what's happening. I don't even know if there's a question in there, but I'd love your comments on that. Sorry.
Yeah, look, really good question, a really good comment in the sense that tying into the broader point, it actually serves as a really good exemplar of what we can achieve up there. In the sense that I'm sitting up here worrying about tension and so forth and opportunism and arms races and whatnot. But that does belie the fact that thus far the attitude and the ethos up there, the philosophy behind it all, has been extraordinary. International cooperation, even during the Cold War, for God's sake, I mean, the two countries were pretty close to nuking each other at one point there, but they were getting along. There's one point of collaboration. Why, I don't know exactly, but one thing that does occur to me is that it does take a pretty unique sort of person to be involved in space exploration in terms of, like, one, very highly educated, doesn't hurt, two, a genuine interest in it, looking beyond. I mean, there's a quote, I think it was Neil Armstrong, I can't remember exactly, you'd know better than me, something about wanting to shake politicians by the scruff of the neck and say, look at that, you bastard, we're all stuck on that together. It does take a vision to be able to aspire to something that high and to work that hard as well. Unfortunately, not quite as rigorous a standard to be a politician.
Our Space Show microphone couldn't pick up all of the audience questions, so I'm going to read a few of them here now. What role should regulation play in space?
Very good question. I can't answer that definitively, but it's funny, actually. Like, I'll give you a good example here. The medical industry, now that's definitely regulated, to say the least, but one of the things that makes that so well-trusted as an organisation, sorry, Ash, I keep looking at you like you asked the question. One of the things that makes that so well-trusted as a profession isn't just the fact that it's regulated. There's no shortage of industries that were heavily, heavily regulated and just did what they wanted anyway. Financial sector coming to mind. But the medical industry is incredibly rigorous, incredibly internally rigorous. It doesn't fly because they won't let it, right? You can imagine, like, so again, I've worked with the financial sector and the medical industry is a complete, got its own problems in different ways. Their internal culture is terrible, but their attitude towards their patients is extraordinarily self-regulated, right? You cannot, in this country, go into a medical clinic of any quality and say, I would like a third arm grafted onto my back, please. It is not happening. It will never happen. I cannot conceive of the level of dodginess that would be necessary for such a thing to be possible in this country. Financial services sector, on the other hand, working with them, and they knew what they were doing, right? Like, they knew. It was like, yeah, we saw an opportunity for profit. Now, this isn't because they're bad people. It's because the internal rigor around that sector was non-existent, right? It was more or less a free-for-all. That was the culture of the organization and the sector was, well, we make profit, which meant that anyone who cared about the effect that was having on their clients got driven out of the industry. They couldn't compete. Medicine, on the other hand, if you started, you know, flying around and doing the cowboy stuff like that, you will be out so fast, and it's got nothing to do with the government. Well, it's something to do with the government, but it also has something to do with the professional association and the internal standards and the pride they take in that sector. So to tie that back to space exploration, what we were saying before about the highly qualified nature of the professionals working in that space, the rigor, the drive, the vision necessary to find yourself into this sort of space, it sort of does the de facto job of that. Was there a second half to that question? I haven't touched on it all there.
The UN.
The UN, yeah. Ah, man. Good question. It might actually be the one place where the UN ends up having teeth because the UN's not very effective in dealing with powerful parties on Earth because there's no third party against which to hold the members accountable, right? You can, you know, within a nation, you can do that with yourself, and other nations can hold another nation accountable, it's like, for example, with Ukraine and Russia right now. But the UN's, it's sort of an amorphous mess on the top. I've always said that the Earth will unify under the UN the day we have aliens show up, basically, because there's something to point at. And unfortunately, again, sort of a relic of human nature. So I doubt we'll ever see a enforceable or a UN with teeth until they've got someone to be having teeth against. But because it's off-planet and therefore currently unowned, I could see it being an extremely effective platform for at least non-binding regulation going forward, or at least stopping us from shooting our own satellites out of the sky.
And Gordon, what about the ethics of artificial intelligence?
You know, that's a really interesting question. All of our ethics are currently aligned to humans. If humans cease to exist, so would ethics, right? It only applies to humans. That in turn begs the question of what happens if there is some form of higher life. It could be artificial intelligence. It could be transhumanism. So if you can upgrade the human brain functionally or something like that. I mean, for example, the one that occurs to me is a hive mind. If our communications technologies progresses on its current trajectory, it's not going to be that far off that we can communicate instantaneously between different minds. And as a result of that, you're going to end up with a certain hive mind-ish thing, right? I can't even imagine what that would look like. But at that point, a lot of human ethics is going to have to change pretty radically because concepts like privacy will not even exist. And so, yeah, there is a need for adaptation. On the other hand, a lot of the ethical methods can work with any given set of facts and facts. So, yeah.
And how do you stand on modifying our brains?
A really good question. You have to ask a biologist. I got no idea, or a sociologist or an anthropologist. I think that if you start to mess with the hardware of the brain, that would basically be the point. I mean, I know we're getting there sort of at the moment, but we are sort of dealing with more the cochlear implant, for example, is going that direction, as is some of these prostheses, power prostheses that are wired more or less directly into the nervous system. Unbelievable stuff, but very functional in nature, right? I think we're not there yet, but if we got to the point where we could understand the coding of the brain, so to speak, and interface that with machinery, imagine having perfect recall, right? I mean, like a computer does. Not that implausible as a theory, but that's not a given anymore as far as I'm concerned. At that point, you're dealing with something completely different.
And the final question came from Peter Arwood.
Okay, fantastic. My question is, By the way, I don't think you'll ever be out of a job with your area of expertise, so congratulations, we're all humans. But the subject of terraforming other planets. Obviously, this is a big red ethics issue, and it's been discussed actually quite a lot. Have you any thoughts about that? And
what would be the risks you see with that?
Some people are opposed to the idea that we should go and mangle another place to suit ourselves.
Drop a bomb on in Mars and make it,
Mars should be left as Mars.
Okay, yeah, I see what you're getting at. Look, it's an interesting question. I don't think we're anywhere near the point where we need to start thinking about preservation of geology. Ethics tends to prefer life, you know what I mean, in the sense that, I mean, rocks don't really have interests. Animals do. Like, this is Peter Singer thing, if I can throw to him, is one of a very well-known Australian philosopher. He tries to get around the whole concept of human rights, because human rights can be kind of limiting in the sense that they only relate to humans, and therefore if we talk about anything else, we kind of flounder. Whereas interests, or a creature having interests, is a more flexible approach, right? A cow has interests. It doesn't have the same interests as a human. It's not interested in both, right? But it does have an interest in not being in pain, right? Much the same as a human does, right? And so it gives you a bit more flexibility in determining personhood in this case. Bluntly put, rocks don't have interests. The only reason I can imagine, I'm more than happy to discuss this, this is a new one for me, but the only reason I could imagine wanting to preserve planets that do not currently support life would be out of human function, or amenity, human amenity, right? In much the same way that we want to preserve like beautiful mountains or anything like that, absolutely, but that also has an ecological function. But like, if you're talking about Mars, think pristine Mars as a cultural artifact or as a scientific endeavor or something like that, this all makes sense. But insofar as we're talking about preserving it for its own sake, so it's a rock. It doesn't have interests. It has nothing. It needs to be protected.
And this has been The Space Show with Andrew Rennie and Richard.